He whacked the others down on the floor. I stood still in the middle of the floor. I couldn't make sense of the wood splinters exploding in the air. May's smirk, saliva, and tears making Ruby's face shiny, as if someone went and shellacked it. I thought that if I stood still, maybe it all would stop. After the houses were ruined, and there was the near silence, the ringing from past noise, Ruby ran out of the house. I had to follow him. I ran down the porch stairs, calling out into the rain, "Ruby! Ruby! Come back!" He didn't answer. I found him close by, in the middle of the yard, standing in the mud. He stooped so he could cry on my shoulder. He was his own rainstorm, and I held him and stroked his wet hair. He loved the houses, and he went and wrecked them. No one had ever told him before that they were stupid. Everyone, that's Dee Dee and I, always said they were extremely beautiful. He wept. It was so cold his tears were the consistency of slush. "Baby," he whimpered, "I just gotta take a walk." I held him up and we started off down the road. We had nothing on but our sweaters and pants, already soaked. It was dark and misty. The cars came slowly out of nowhere and splashed us at the side of the road. I didn't ask where we were going. We must have walked halfway to Stillwater, holding hands, not saying a word. When we came to the house, it was all lit up. I knew, by the sixth sense, when Ruby turned up the drive, that it was where Hazel lived, with her cousin Isabel, and whoever else happened to be around. Every single light was on. Ruby walked right into the house without knocking. Hazel and Isabel were in the kitchen, playing gin rummy. They must have been at it for a while, because there were lots of empty bottles around. Their kitchen was spacious, but all they had was a small white linoleum table against the wall and two yellow kitchen chairs with the stuffing coming out. There were bottles everywhere and empty shelves, as if they never had the occasion to eat or cook in the room. When Hazel bothered to look up, she said, "Well, if it ain't the newlyweds." Then she looked at us more carefully and said, "Hey, Izzy, do you think it's Halloween? Don't them two look like they're dressed up as drowned rats?" She laughed at her joke and then got serious. "Do we have any candy?" Isabel was quiet. She was young and blonde and had a waist the size of a signpost. She was bored by everything, even jokes. Ruby pulled up a stool and helped himself to an open beer while I stood, waiting again for the scene to evaporate. I was convinced that if I stood long enough that it would just go away. After a long time listening to the two slap their cards and shuffle and deal, and listening to Ruby guzzle and burp, Hazel looked up again and said, "I bet Mrs. Dow would love to see the zoo." "No, she don't," Ruby said. But Hazel had me by the hand. She took me down the basement and turned the light on, and I saw the snake cages on one wall and the mice cages on the other. "We'll get one of the constrictors for you to hold, sweetheart," she said to me, smiling so that her smooth face wrinkled up. While she fiddled with the latch, she said, "I bet Ruby's told you all about me. All about our magic times down here." I whispered, "No." She laughed and said, "You mean he don't brag about the time he nipped my boobs so bad I was a living bloodbath?" She had a puckered look come over her for a split second, and then she turned to the snake and crooned, "Come on, honey bum." I took the thing in both of my hands, wondering when I was going to wake up. "Take it to Ruby," she said, He loves my pets. I carried the python up while it slowly wrapped around my arm. It was 4 feet long and as big around as Isabel's waist. I didn't mind it so much. It hadn't asked to be Hazel's snake. When I came up into the light of the kitchen, Ruby took one look at me and put the whiskey bottle down. He retched into his sleeve and was gone out the door. If I had had my wits about me, I would have thanked Hazel for making him leave. But as soon as I could unwind the creature from my arm, I set him on the table and followed Ruby. I caught up with him near home. He had his pocket-sized pancake syrup jug full of liquor, and we drank as we walked along. I had hundreds of questions I wanted to ask him, such as, why did we go there? But I was afraid to ask him. I was afraid Ruby would say, they are my best friends. I knew that a person always got the urge to see their best friend when they found themselves in trouble. For a while we sat with the hens. Ruby finally said, I like birds better than people. He took a drink and said, I bet angels look like doves, white ones. Sure, I said. We sat out there drinking and singing Sunshine on My Shoulders and other songs by Ruby's favorite composer, John Denver. Every now and then, Ruby would start daydreaming about how he was going to climb mountains with John Denver, the tallest mountains, and all you'd have to do is take one little step off the top and you'd be in heaven. I didn't correct him. I didn't say if he stepped off years later, somebody would find a skeleton in the darkest valley, and they'd know it was Ruby by his black front tooth. It took me a long time to get up my nerve, but when I finally got it, I blurted, How come you bit Hazel? Ruby laughed one of his genuine laughs, not the big ha-has that meant he's nervous. He said, She took me down to her zoo one day. Calls out, Who wants to be lunch? Then she grabs a mousie from a cage and beats it with a ruler in the wastebasket. He looked like he was going to be sick again. She made me watch the snake eat it up. Baby, he whispered. She deserved to be bit. If she hadn't squirmed so much, I would have swallowed her whole. We didn't say anything more. We slumped down and lay still. Finally, we climbed the back steps, clutching each other, stiff and shivering. The whiskey was long gone, and the old horse blanket I'd found in the barn was soaked from our wet skins. After May went to work in the morning, I called up Artie and told him I was sick as a dead pig. It was not a lie. Ruby and I were both feverish. We lay in bed throwing wads of Kleenex on the floor. We didn't do anything but lie there side by side, throwing off the covers 1 minute and then the next huddling under them, all the while trying to breathe. When May came home in the evening, she was prepared to be huffy and prim. She was probably dying to know where we'd been all night, but she wasn't about to ask. We could hear her walking around downstairs, looking for us, so she could show us her aloof personality. Finally, she heaved upstairs. She came and stood by our door. She could not figure out what was going on. When she peered in and saw us on our bed, I started sneezing and moaning. It was a good show. My head felt like a bowl full of hot applesauce, and I couldn't breathe. I felt as if I was going to suffocate from all my clogged byways. Ruby wasn't any better off. Plus, he had to vomit now and then in a bucket. Side effects of the whiskey.
Don't stand there staring, Ma, I snorted. Look what you've done to us, chasing us out of the house. I started to cry. I said, I think you better apologize to my husband, Ruby. Of course May never says she's sorry, but she did make us chicken soup. She brought us Cokes. She felt halfway responsible. I know she did, for the fact that we were so miserable. She could hear our sniffles and our whimpering. She must have actually felt guilty, because she took the next day off. She waited on us hand and toe. In between some of the shows she watched on TV, she put trays of orange juice outside our door. We could come and fetch some whenever we were thirsty. And when I came down for lunch, she made me stick the thermometer in my mouth. After she read it, she shook it out so vigorously, I doubted her advanced age. She could have been a head nurse easily. We never mentioned the scene in our kitchen. We put it away, inside ourselves. But those birdhouses were the last Ruby ever made in his whole life, as far as I know. It wasn't too long after our sickness that I found out. We were going along, having our silent suppers, but it wasn't like we were at the end of our ropes anymore. We were tired and quiet. We were sick to death of winter and our fighting. I was at Trim and Tidy one day, watching the stains go by me, the dirt and grease speckling the clothes, and the wave came over me. There wasn't any way my breakfast was going to remain in my stomach. I started staggering around the back room. Artie came to me, grabbed my elbow, and said, "What's the matter, sweetie?" "I don't know," I said. And then for no reason I sat down and cried, again, for about the billionth time that year. It seemed to me that I was weeping for the race of man, for everyone who had ever lived through adolescence and marriage and then died. I went into the restroom just in time, and of course after the vomiting I had to cry some more, leaning over the sink. Artie demanded that I call the doctor at the clinic. He stood next to me while I explained over the phone that I couldn't hold anything down in my stomach, and he made me ask if it was food poisoning on account of sharing Louise's old hard-boiled Easter eggs. The doctor asked me some questions, and then he said, "It sounds to me like what you have is a baby, Mrs. Dow." "No," I said, "no." I turned away from Artie and whispered into the receiver, "I've only been married 6 months." "That's about how long it takes," he said. For some reason, it never occurred to me that it was a baby inside making me sick, because all the time I had been trying to keep track of May and Ruby. That was an enormous job. I didn't think of anything else but our relationships together. Also, expert Ruby said I wouldn't get pregnant if I washed myself off very carefully. Artie must have guessed, because he slowly backed off from the phone and left me alone. A few days later, I had an appointment at the clinic. Louise had to go to town, so she drove me in during lunch. They took blood and wished me luck. I couldn't wait for the nurses to tell me the news. I suspended myself for 3 days, like I was a hung garment in the closet. I didn't think of one single thing except the baby inside me. I knew it was there. I knew absolutely. That's why I felt so sad one minute, and then the next, like I was a rocket going straight up to the Sword of Orion, one of my favorite places. I didn't tell anyone about the possibility. Finally, they called me at work and said the test was accurate. I was going to have a baby. Naturally, I instantly sat down and bawled. I was thinking about the night our baby probably came to life, when we were both loaded up to our eyeballs. I wondered if that meant it was going to be born drunk, if it would come out without the capacity to imagine and remember. It was Artie who came to me again, and I couldn't help telling him. He seemed to know everything. He said most new mothers worried that their babies were going to come out mooing like a cow or squawking like a chicken. I loved him so much, not only because he was short, with a little round head and hair so thin it looked like a cloud traveling over his skull, but because he patted my hand and said, "Don't worry." He looked me in the eye and said, "No more liquor.
No more smokes. Then he laughed again and said, Why ain't I in the medical profession? I nodded my head and said he could be my doctor any old day. I swear it had been raining solid through March and now into April. Perhaps it was just my spirit. The fields were so muddy they beckoned me each day to sink in and wait for the day when I could sprout along with the plants, start a whole new life. But the afternoon I found out, and Artie said I shouldn't worry, the sun appeared, and the air was warm. I couldn't believe my luck. I came home, went straight into the living room, and announced, Ruby, we are going to celebrate. And he said, Great, baby, without asking what it was for. He didn't care, as long as he could be giddy and party. I told May, matter-of-factly, we were taking the car. I didn't give her a chance to come out of shock and say, No, you don't. We went to Audrey's, and when we were seated, I said, Ruby, I'm not supposed to drink beer. Really, baby? That don't sound like too much fun. Guess why? I said. He was trying to figure out the menu. He couldn't think of a reason. I reached over and held his hand. I said, You and me, Ruby, we're going to have a little baby. His eyes just about popped out of his sockets while that slow smile spread over his face. He asked me, What did you say? And I told him again. I showed him about where it was inside of me, way down by my fly. He got so excited he knocked over his water glass. He whispered, We're going to have a jungle baby. He made his fingers dance all over the placemats to his favorite song that goes, Do-do-do-do-do. Then he told the waitress his wife was PG. He said he was the father, and he asked her what we should name it. I laughed at Ruby, asking the dumb waitress what we're going to name our own baby. When we finished our supper, Ruby came over and held my elbow while I stood up. He was already being sweet and careful with me. He kept saying, Baby, you got a person inside of you. I wish I could peek in there and see what it's up to. We walked in the kitchen at home looking so happy. I know we did. And May said, What's going on with you two? You got some big secret? And Ruby blurted out, She's gonna have a baby, he said so nicely to May. Hey, Ma, that means you're a grandmother. She sat down. She didn't know what to make of it. I took out a minuscule T-shirt I'd got at the grocery store, and I said, Look, Ma, look at how small it's going to be. She didn't say anything for 3 days. I was so nervous in front of her, I didn't know where to look when she was in the room. I tiptoed and knocked over vases. I couldn't tell if she was mad or what. On Sunday after church, she cut the first tulips. We were all sure winter was truly over. She came in the kitchen with tulips and a gift box. She handed the present to me and said, Don't just sit there, open it. I did without saying a word. It was a yellow fuzzy suit that keeps babies toasty. See what I got for my grandson? She said, wiping her nose. She already had it figured out. It was going to be a boy. Chapter 14. By the time the month of May came, and there were purple and red tulips, and yellow daffodils all over the lawn, and the grass was so lush and green, I half hoped someone would put me out to pasture. We had a better attitude about living together on the planet. We weren't burning oil to keep us warm. Everything we needed, it seemed, was right out the back door. May and Ruby and I now had the habit of sitting at supper with the kitchen door open, the smells of the steaming ground coming in, and we talked about what the baby was going to be like. We couldn't be quiet at the table because we had stories to tell. We were planning together. We were in the future together. We bought wallpaper with clowns on it for the nursery. May bargained with the lady at the hardware store and got it cheap. She repeatedly described how she had had her babies. All of a sudden, giving birth was the biggest drama May had ever lived through. She talked about her infants as if they were dear and long dead. She didn't make the connection that I was what sprang out of her. She said perhaps the baby would have an enormous intelligent brain like Matt's, and he would achieve in school. Wouldn't we be surprised? Ruby, sucking up his macaroni from his spoon, said the baby was going to be a baseball star. He'd play on the Cubs team, make them Cubbies win. I sat back and grinned at them both, the way they were carrying on. I had to ask, what if it's a girl? Ruby took a bite of the peanut butter sandwich he had on the side, and he said with his mouth full, a girl can play on the Cubs too. May snickered and said, don't kid yourself, Buster. They don't let girls do one thing except wash uniforms and clean out the shower stalls. I felt lousy half the time, but I tried to shrug it off. I kept telling myself that I was going to get a baby out of the arrangement. I sat by the window pretending I was on an ocean vessel. I imagined I was on a cruise with fancy food prepared by experts. It didn't matter that I couldn't eat any of it, even though the waiters offered me shrimp from a silver platter. I was thankful to be on the boat, rocking back and forth, looking out to the sparkly blue water. I tried to think those voyage thoughts when I felt seasick all day long. I sat in the window and watched Ruby helping May rake up last year's leaves. She gave orders, and he did just what she said. He had the humiliation buried away. He was practically enthusiastic. I suppose they had a common purpose. He hardly missed any spots that she said to rake clean. He took care of the chickens, too, after I told him the feel of the warm eggs made me gag. He said, baby, you don't lift one of them little white fingers of yours. I'm going to take care of the hens. Ruby and May weren't hugging each other after long absences, but they seemed to be making a special effort while I was upstairs in the bathroom waiting to heave. He still did the things that irked May. She hated the way he came down the stairs in the morning with nothing on except a towel wrapped around his waist. His eyes weren't open yet. She looked every which way around him. Possibly Daisy was right. Perhaps if May had glanced at a near-naked Ruby, she would have knocked him down, ripped off his towel, and forced herself. Maybe she was lusty. She didn't really seem in the market for such things, but perhaps when I'm at advanced age, I'll understand. He left eggshells on the counter and the cereal box out. There was usually a puddle of milk by his glass and a licked jelly spoon in the puddle. He isn't the tidiest person we ever met. She hated the way he dumped into the chair and turned on the TV. Still, she had something else to occupy her mind now. She didn't have to concentrate on Ruby's mess. And since I was home more, I could clean up after him, hide the traces. He wasn't actually what you'd call a slob, that much. He just didn't notice items if they were out of place. Maybe we were all feeling extra generous and trying to shape up a little, since in the future we were going to have to be examples. It could have been my hormones crisscrossing through my body in massive doses, but I felt a lot sorrier for people than usual. One day in the early summer, I walked into the Foots' house, and I could tell instantly that one of the Foot children had done something seriously wrong. Dee Dee had her head set tight into her neck, and her shoulders came up to her ears. She was furiously balling up cookie dough and splatting it on her trays.
She had 3 earthenware bowls filled with dough. She had all the grease trays lined up in a row. I wasn't about to tangle with her, so I walked past her into the living room. Daisy was home from Peoria for a week, sewing padding into the top of her swimming suit. I raised my eyebrows to ask her what was going on. "You don't want to know," she said, glad for the opportunity to tell me. "Randall's got a girlfriend." She looked straight at me. She lives over on the Kate's old place. Naturally, I was surprised. Furthermore, I didn't know there was anyone eligible living there. I started to ask who, but Daisy said, "Bah." I stood staring while Daisy stuck her tongue into her cheek to keep from laughing. It didn't take me long to understand. Ruby had told me the plots of the movies he and Randall loved to drool over. I nodded my head and went out the front door. I walked for a long time before I saw him. He was in the cemetery, sitting on a large rectangular gravestone. His knees came up to his chin. "Move over," I said. He did. "Just a little more." He moved around the corner, and we sat back touching back. "I never thought anyone was going to like me," I said. "I know I ain't pretty." I felt his back sink into mine a little, but I got taken by surprise, and I bet sometime you might be surprised too. When he started to cry, I got up and went around to his side. I kneeled down and kissed him on his fat, wet lips. I moved his hair out of his eyes as tenderly as I could and felt along his bristly cheek. Then I kissed him again. He kept his eyes closed. "You sure are a handsome fat man," I said. "No," he said, looking sideways and wiping the tears from his cheeks. "One more," I said, kissing him again. "Now go home to your mother. She's got some cookies for you." I got up and walked away, and when I turned around, I saw him lumbering in the other direction. He moved slowly, because if he walked quickly, his thighs rubbing together probably would have started a fire. He took up so much space, cars passing him swerved way over to the other side of the road. For the first time, watching him lug his body home, I felt how lonesome he would always be. Dee Dee and Randall came every day that summer, because May and Dee Dee were making a quilt for the baby. Randall was hanging round a lot more than usual, watching the ladies sew. I could tell that May was looking out for him, too. She made sure his plate was always full, and she patted him on the back. He had his stool drawn up to the table, and with his change purse in his clutches, he pored over his Mad magazines. They all sat in the dining room with the fan blowing on them, Dee Dee's behind, lapping over the edge of her stool, and she and May talked about babies for hours. They talked without listening to each other. Even then, I knew they had amnesia. They were talking with fondness in their voices. They recalled how a baby's neck smells and how it gurgles. They laughed at the way toddlers can wreck a house if you let them. I lay on the sofa feeling the glow of pride creep all the way up to my forehead. I was doing something they were awfully excited about, and they didn't try to hide it. Dee Dee missed the world of infants because her daughter Lou had given up midnight star Sandra Dee when she realized having a baby wasn't a picnic, even if she was the only mother in the sophomore class. She went south, gave it up for adoption, and moved into a house with a lot of girls. She sent word that she was working long night shifts waitressing. But Daisy had a theory about the true nature of her long nights. Dee Dee blew her nose and frowned every time she thought about Lou. Her breasts heaved so that the dress zippered down her front undid itself an inch or two. The quilt was a light blue pond with green and orange ducks swimming around the reeds. May said there wasn't going to be one spot of pink in it. I didn't do anything but lie on the couch in the living room while they stitched. Randall lent me his reel-to-reel tape recorder, and Dee Dee got me some blind tapes through the library. I had to call in sick to trim and tidy half the time, because I was so hot and miserable. I lay on the couch listening to my favorite books by Charles Dickens, in particular that one called Bleak House. It's about 1,000,000 years long, and that's hardly exaggerating. It has Esther in it, the heroine in literature I root for the most. I always felt so sorry for her because she had a very pure heart, and all the same, there were people who treated her cruelly. I wished I could be some kind of magical wise person who was able to walk into books and change their course. I would slip in and be Esther's long-lost sister, comfort little Joe before he died, tell Ada that loving Richard Carston was a dead end, and finally melt the ice out of Lady Dedlock's heart and reunite her with Esther and me, and then we'd both inherit her fortune. May was bossy with me, but I could laugh behind my pale, sick face because I knew she was thinking about the baby. She said so sternly that I had to have vegetables, and she butchered 2 chickens and fried me their livers. They made my stomach do cartwheels, so she fed the organs to Randall, with chocolate cake on the side. We were all ready to be happy about something. It almost didn't matter what. If we had had a dog that was going to have puppies, May probably would have fried up livers for the bitch and sewed a quilt for the puppies to lie on. She had been waiting for something great in her life for a long time, ever since Matt left home and I met Ruby. Finally, in September, I started feeling better. I woke up one morning and told Ruby I had to have a cheeseburger without delay. He ran and told May, and she made me one lickety-split. She sprinkled olives on top and set me a place with the doily napkins. I had figured out how to be a queen quite by accident. Everyone was concerned about me. If I picked up the laundry basket, say, both May and Dee Dee ordered me to put it down. They yelled in unison, as if they were trying to sing a duet. I did exactly what they said. Even Ruby took the laundry himself and hung it on the line. Never mind that he left it out in the rain, and we didn't have any clean underwear. I love being pregnant, feeling like a big old elephant. Some girls hate the sensation, I know, but if you throw your shoulders back and let your belly lead you down the street, never fails. People smile going by. I love how suddenly everything tiny seems beautiful. The tiniest, thinnest blade of grass. You want to go out and put a fence around it so no one will step on it. I like thinking about the drama going on in a mother's body. For instance, Artie told me the fluid the baby grows in is the same as the salt water in the sea. Exactly. That information gave me goose pimples, and I felt glad knowing porpoises are my cousins. I could almost remember jumping up to get the fish out of my keeper's hands. Although I'm a small person, during my first pregnancy, Ruby said my stomach was as tremendous as them blown-up hot air balloons. When he walked with me in town, he loved to watch people thinking I was a fat girl. He swelled and beamed, knowing that he was the one who did it to me. The doctor at the clinic told us about classes at the hospital in Humphrey, where nurses teach girls how to grin through labor. He said we ought to attend. I got up my nerve and asked May to write a check for $25 so we could go to class. She only scowled for a minute. There were 10 other couples learning about babies also. I knew everyone was examining us in great detail. I felt their eyes piercing through the holes in my shoes and the tears in my socks. At the cleaners, you don't actually have to talk to the people. You say the same conversation all day long, like, "Is it cold enough out there for you?"
And then you tell them how much their clean clothes cost. And naturally, at the end, you say, "Have a nice day." But in the childbirth class, the couples were so different from us. We had to go around and say what our occupation was. 99% were physical therapists and salesmen. One of the ladies worked on a newspaper writing stories. Ruby said right out he was the can man in the grocery store parking lot. He sang it out. And I said quietly that I was the spotter at Trim and Tidy. Our teacher, Sylvia, had to ask, "What did you say? Can you speak up?" I could tell people were laughing at us or commenting, "Oh, brother," under their breaths. We were right back in grade school again, saying the wrong answer, sounding dumb. The other mothers had blonde hair, all of them, I'm not lying, nice and straight. And they dressed in pink maternity sweaters with initials on the front. Their plump, soft faces made them all look like identical stuffed animals. I knew we were poor and strange against the people in our class. Sometimes I felt so sad for my baby. I didn't want it to see the world, if it was going to find out about our oddness. I talked to it down in my stomach. I told it not to worry. We'd hide it away. We wouldn't let other children taunt it. We'd chase bullies out of the yard and throw stones after them. It always relieved me to get home, back with my Ruby, back up to our room. He played his music on his guitar with the radio, and he'd say, "Okay, baby, breathe in, breathe out. Let's practice you having a kid. Look at the speck on the wall and imagine all them magic nights we've had. Breathe in one of them cleansing breaths. Pant, blow, pant, blow." One night, he pretended he was the doctor giving me a cesarean section. He strapped a flashlight bulb to his head and outlined my stomach with his fingernail. He told me, "I'm going to open you up and get the kid out in no time flat. I got to fish in real quick before you wake up." I laughed and squirmed, and then he tore the rest of my clothes off. He whispered he was going to keep me pregnant all the time because he liked my boobies to be the size of a cow's bag. Artie kept saying that I was the best worker, and what was he going to do when I had Oscar? I said, "Artie, you think I'm going to quit? How do you think I'm supposed to pay for our Oscar's doctor bills if I'm not working?" Artie was good to me as always, because he said when it was born, he'd figure out a part-time schedule for both May and me. Those 9 months were serene. I worked, thinking about the baby every other minute. My mind wasn't at Trim and Tidy. My mind was inside my stomach with our child. We were swimming around together like goldfish circling in a bowl. I felt the world closing in on me. The space in front of me was getting smaller and smaller until all I could see was my family and the threesome we were to become. I told Daisy, when she came home from Peoria for a week, that I was with my baby constantly, and she looked at me as if I was cracked. "You think you're swimming inside your own stomach?" she said. "Maybe that baby is growing in your head and it's going to swim down your nose." She smirked at her joke. I didn't tell her further thoughts about being a mother, but when I felt the baby, I had to stop whatever I was doing, no matter who was present. I had to put the steam iron down, hold my stomach to feel the kicks. Ruby felt the movements, too. We sat in bed and he put his ear against me to listen. "Baby," he whispered, "it's spooky in there inside of you." We didn't notice the winter coming on because we were preoccupied with ourselves. We didn't mind how cold it was getting. The night of our anniversary, Ruby brought home pizzas with some coaching on the part of Dee Dee, and all of us sat in the kitchen talking about what we should name the baby. I never said out loud the name I wanted. I was keeping it secret. I went along with Ruby and May very agreeably. May bought a book from the store filled with names, and she read them to us. It took her 2 hours just for the boys. The one she wanted was Josiah, but to me it sounded like those old men in the Bible who are always getting into trouble with God. Ruby liked the name Clover. He said it should be called Clover Reuben Dahl. May said if we named it that, it would turn into a homo. I've never seen one that I know of, so I can't tell if it's a bad way to be. I said no way in a million years was our baby going to be called Clover. We might as well call it Wheat Groats or Quack Grass. After Ruby watched a Bewitched rerun one night, he declared the baby was going to be christened Darren. I smiled at him and whispered, "You're out of your gourd." I stopped working in December. I couldn't get through the doors. I was waiting. All I could do was wait, staring at nothing, crying all of a sudden for no reason. I felt so large, as if there were a gigantic hen inside me, scratching with its feet. I had dreams that our infant chicken burst out of my stomach. I woke up thinking there wasn't anything left of my belly. There was eggshells scattered on the floor, a baby shaking its downy skin beside me. I couldn't get anything done at home. I was trying to paint the crib Dee Dee loaned us. I'd stand up to start a task, and it always looked so tiresome I had to sit back down and stare at the open can of paint. Ruby and I watched TV. We watched the soap operas where people don't have to do anything except fall in love with the wrong person. They wear so much hairspray, not one piece of hair gets dislodged, even when they're kissing each other's bruised mouths. We didn't do much else except play cards and get headaches from staring at kings and queens and spades. On New Year's Eve, I didn't celebrate. I was big and tired. I didn't ever get rest because our baby went on hikes at bedtime. It was training with those clubs that go up that stupid giant Mount Everest. Artie's son climbs mountains. Artie always tells me how many people died on certain peaks, right when they were 2 inches from the top. At any rate, Ruby and I were asleep when suddenly I woke up. My side of the bed was soaked. I didn't think I could have wet the bed. I hadn't done that since I was 9. I knew that it was my water bag busted. "Ruby," I said, nudging him, "wake up. We have to go to the hospital." He sat bolt upright. He didn't have one piece of clothing on, and he said, "I'm ready." "You ain't ready either," I said, laughing. "You're a nudie man." He grinned at me in the dark. I could see that dazzling smile of his shining through the murky night. We woke up May and explained that we were on our way to the hospital, and she said, "I'm coming with." She put her clothes on before we could ask if she meant it. Her outfit had been folded neatly by her bed just for the occasion. So we three bundled into the car. It's only 2 a.m. and 10 below 0, and May said, "It's colder than a witch's tit in a copper bra." We were all so frozen, none of us laughed. What she said was true. May couldn't come into the labor room, no matter how long she swore at the nurse, just barely under her breath. She had to wait outside in the father's lounge. She smoked about 10 packs of cigarettes with Dee Dee, who lied to the nurses, telling them she was Ruby's mother. The nurses said they didn't usually have both grandmothers there, too, and I mumbled something about how I guessed we were different. Nothing much was happening, so we played crazy eights. I beat Ruby each time. I could tell his brain wasn't on function. He was nervous about being in a hospital. He went out of the room each time the nurse came in to check on my progress. When the contractions got closer together, they hooked me to a machine that measures the pains. Ruby watched it so he could see how miserable I felt. "Baby," he said, looking at the screen, It's a good thing them waves ain't from your brain. They put you in the circus. I had to laugh over that one. Ruby was always cheering me up. He sat down in the chair and got out his carton of food he had brought with him. He was diving into the box of Wheaties when he looked up and said, "Hey, baby, remember to do all the breathing you learned about. You're gonna do real good. I just know it." The husbands were supposed to say that to the wives. They were supposed to encourage them. He concentrated awfully hard when I said he had to throw ice water on my face. There were frown lines on his forehead. He wanted to do a perfect job. He said, "Ain't I a great coach for you?" I managed to say, "Yes, Ruby." I was so glad he was my husband. I knew May was impressed that the fathers got to assist at the birth. As the pains came stronger and closer together, I kept asking myself, "Is this actually happening to me? Aren't I still the little girl who's getting laughed at for not having a brassiere? Why aren't I at the kitchen table while my daddy's dumping ice cream on top of my head?" All of a sudden, it seemed that my life had gone so quickly. I was in labor for 16 hours. Ruby looked like a car wreck after 8. When I was having the contractions, I remembered pulling the little lamb from the mother's sheep so long ago, and how she didn't complain, although her eyeballs were in the back of her head. I thought about her and tried not to moan too loudly. I tried not to call out to God and the devil, but their names came soaring from my mouth and then echoed around the room. I told the doctor I didn't want to have a baby anymore, that all I wanted was a shot in my thigh which would erase me. He said, "It won't be long now." I was glad I couldn't see myself having a baby. I bet my face looked like a raisin somebody stepped on. I kept trying to get Ruby's attention so I could ask him if I was going to the ladies' room all over the bed, but he had wandered off to the TV screen. I just knew the doctor was going to bawl me out for messing the sheets. Finally, the doctor said again that it wouldn't be long, and Ruby called out, "Come on, baby, let's get this show on the road." I pushed as if I had a Greyhound bus deluxe coach inside me, stuck between 2 snowbanks. The doctor counted to 10 repeatedly while I screamed and groaned. "I don't have no energy," I cried after forever, and the doctor said that the head was practically out. A few more good pushes was going to wrap it up. I tried. I mustered my forces. I revved that bus's engine, and at last, splam, comes a slippery small package with white film all over it. Dr. Hansen caught it on the fly. Ruby looked over and said, "Hey, Doc, you'd be a great outfielder if you was younger." "Oh, sweetie," I choked. "Oh, angel." Ruby sat back into the chair. He probably was crying, too. I couldn't see his face while he stared at the wall. The nurse cleaned up our baby, and then they brought it to me. I touched him, and he looked at me with the darkest blue eyes. They were so blue, like the mill pond in spring. "It's our Justin," I whispered, because that's the name I had chosen. He was something I had made from scratch. He was our Justin. "Come see," I said to Ruby, who was still having a catnap. When I spoke louder, he pulled himself up and walked over on his tiptoes. He looked about the way he used to look when I tried to get him to reach under and grab a hen's egg. I kept saying our baby's name time and time again. We were meeting for the first time in our lives. The nurse came and helped me put him on my nipple. He sucked so knowledgeably, I had to boast right away about his appetite and his intelligence. He made little grunting noises, enjoying the very best food he had ever tasted. I checked our baby, made sure he had 10 toes. I couldn't believe that he came out with eyebrows, and he could grimace and cry. He had wrists thinner than an electrician's conduit, and perfect small hands, better than fresh rosy apricots. He looked exactly like Ruby. He was bound to be handsome. Right away, when they wheeled me to my room, May came in. She wasn't supposed to be there, but she bulldozed over the nurses. "Here's your grandson, Ma," I said. "Meet Justin." She patted his cheek. She didn't say anything except, "Bless you," to him, in a thin, wavering voice, one I had never heard her use before. She couldn't believe that here in the flesh was another chance for her. Here was a baby coming to live and grow at her house. She was listening, already, to the stories Justy was going to tell about his grandmother. How she leaped up on the roof when the house was burning and pulled him from the fire.
Chapter 15. Justy was born with absolutely no baby spots. He came out complete and flawless. I'm not even prejudiced. The nurses said he was one of the most beautiful babies they had ever seen, and nurses have been around the block a few times. It was as if Ruby and I weren't poor, ugly people, but actually, in our blood and bones and seeds, royal monarchs. May kept saying, "It's a miracle he's so damn pretty." I was happiest when there was no one else in the hospital room, only Justy and his mother. He looked up at me with his wise blue eyes, saying, "It's all right now. I'm here." J.C. was supposed to say those words when he was born, but I knew Jesus wasn't any better than our Justin. He wasn't any more of a holy big deal than our own baby. 3 days in the hospital were the closest to heaven I'll probably ever get. I love filling in the menu chart, circling whatever I wanted to eat, and then they brought it, steaming and fragrant. They propped up my pillows so I could eat in bed. The nurses were always swooping in and out of the room like barn swallows, offering to give me little baths that heal the wounds. Ruby and Dee Dee came to visit me in the afternoons, and Ruby brought me beer because it's supposed to be good for nursing mothers. It lets their milk come down. Dee Dee gave Ruby that information when she was guzzling a 12-pack for old time's sake. Ruby and I looked at Justy. That's all we did. We couldn't stop looking at him. Ruby flipped through the TV channels with the remote control panel he loved so much. He held Justy awkwardly, with his shoulders all hunched up, since he had never been around a newborn. And when Justy cried, Ruby said, "Okay, little baby. You want to go back to your mama?" He said "mama" deliberately, as if he had just learned an exotic word. I beamed hearing him comfort Justin. He'd say, "There, don't you cry now. Here's your mama." And when I held Justy, I could give him what he wanted. He usually stopped crying. I admired how I knew what to do without having to go to some school way down in Peoria to learn about it. When you're a mother, you know what your baby needs. Also, the nurses gave me, along with some other girls, classes about washing and changing your infant. Ruby thought I was the smartest person on earth for jiggling Justy and making him quiet down and talking sweetly in a high voice to him. He looked forlorn in his corner sometimes when I was speaking to Justy. He'd pipe up and say that he couldn't wait to get me home. He was going to eat me whole. "It's been a long time, baby," he'd say. "I can't wait until it ain't like climbing a mountain to get on top of you." When he brought up that mountain climbing topic, I quick said I had to take a nap. I closed my eyes and prayed for divine interference to freeze Ruby's appetite. All my life, When we went to church, I didn't listen hard to what the Rev said. I sat in the pew thinking about the dirt on people's collars and the way their hair hit the back of their necks. But every now and then, some of Rev's words blasted through. They sat in my ears for some reason, and I had to perk up and think. Right after Justy was born, I fidgeted in church until the Rev said, "Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are they which do hunger and thirst after righteousness, for they shall be filled. Blessed are the pure of heart, for they shall see God." The Rev, no doubt, had said those verses hundreds of times when I wasn't paying attention, but for once I heard the words. I sat still in the pew, biting my lip, filling my head with the phrase, "For they shall inherit the earth." I didn't know what that involved precisely, or where you had to go to put in your claim, but I knew Justy had something to do with the deal, now that he was a part of the earth, and I had made him myself. Justy would carry on from where I left off, and it was my body which gave him the life to do it, plus Ruby's. I figured I was going to inherit the earth in a way I didn't yet know about. I was in a special club because I had made a human being to do the work of man. Ever since I was a little girl, I only half believed in the fabrications the Rev preached. After Aunt Sid got me thinking about symbols, I knew the baby Jesus never actually was born at Christmas. I figured the Rev was merely telling stories that were designed to make us behave. Still, there were the times when he said poems, like how the meek are blessed, and I fiercely wanted to believe the promises. May went out and bought Justy a blue dress with smocking across the front for his baptism. It probably cost her a fortune, but money in this case was no object. She said we had to get Justy baptized, because then he wouldn't go to hell, guaranteed. There's an old man in our church, Oscar Bailey, who rants and raves about Jesus to anyone who will give him the ear. He was forever musing about the savages in the jungles around the world who've never heard of Christ. He couldn't help feeling sorry for them because they don't have anyone to tell them the gospel. Finally, after several weeks of pondering, he decided there was comfort after all. He figured Jesus could eyeball each savage's heart and say which one would accept him if they knew about him. And that way certain Africans are surely saved. Oscar was telling me this opinion on the day Justy got baptized. He was giving the benefit of the doubt to the poor dumb savages. I forced a sweet smile while I held Justy in my arms so I'd look like the good mother. I wanted to tell Oscar he was full of it, that Jesus wasn't anything more than a figment in his mind, and that savages were much better off without Jesus' mumbo-jumbo. For example, they didn't have to fight wars to force their neighbors to go to church. I didn't say boo, however. We had, only 10 minutes before, stood up in front of the altar. I had held Justy while the Rev sprinkled water on his head and told us we were supposed to raise our son a Christian. I had nodded. There were only 100 people watching. How was I going to inform the Rev that I didn't believe in the man? The ladies at coffee hour afterwards said how beautiful Justy looked. It was true. He had lush dark hair and a delicate thin mouth and round blue eyes the size of half dollars and a long nose, fit for the princes they have over in England. He crossed his eyes and then smiled, as if seeing us double was twice the pleasure. For the first 3 months, I was allowed to stay home with Justy. Artie said I wouldn't lose my job, that it would be there when I was ready. He called to say that Trim and Tidy never won bowling games against the Red Bell Market on account of I wasn't there to score. I have to admit, I kind of miss seeing the team trophy Artie has on display at the cleaners. It's the one we got after I did the miracle shot. The 7 and 10 split. If I ever have the chance to go back and live my days over, the first months with Justy are the ones I'd choose. It was like real life, how I always imagined it was supposed to be. May went to work in the morning, and then Mr. and Mrs. Dow were adults keeping house, blasting the roof off with our furious vacuuming and our love songs. I kept asking myself, am I a real live woman? Is my body actually making the milk in my breasts? Is this truly my husband who's handing me the talcum powder so I can make our baby clean and dry? I asked questions constantly to make sure it all wasn't one magic cream puff. After May was gone to work, we cooked ourselves breakfast. Ruby fried the bacon because I always felt as if I could eat something fresh killed. I loved being so hungry, and then hearing Justy cry, and feeling the sting of the milk let down. Ruby said he wished he could get coke from my nipples. He said then I could feed the neighborhood and we'd get rich. When I was eating and Justy bawled, Ruby picked him up from his basket when I said, and handed him to me, and I'd feed him. Justy didn't have any problems with his appetite. He sucked and grunted and smacked his lips. May said that I had it made, that Justy was an angel baby, so well behaved. I don't think Justy's good nature was all luck. Probably his parents had something to do with it. I see so clearly, as if it were an hour ago, Ruby washing up the dishes, just as I'd told him. He didn't complain too long, and singing a tune to himself while our baby nursed. He made up songs for Justy, about how Justy was riding his horse across the range, how he was the biggest, smartest cowboy killing off Indian tribes. Then, after Justy ate, I gave him over to Ruby. I showed him patiently how to burp a baby, and he did the job very gently. He sang some more in his soprano voice, songs such as Colorado Rocky Mountain High and Jet Plane. Sometimes, after I healed, when I sat on the couch with our baby smiling up at me, Ruby came over and felt my breasts. He liked them gigantic. He petted my hair and face. He said certain equipment he had was swelling to the size of a fungo bat. He was missing me urgently. I had to laugh at my two babies. I had to glow triumphantly at how they were ravenous for my body. If Justy was sleeping, I put him in his basket. Then Ruby and I climbed upstairs to our room, and we shut the door. I had enough company with my family. I didn't have energy to spare. I didn't want to talk with other mothers in Stillwater. They have a group of people who nurse their babies. They get together twice a month to chew the fat, eat cupcakes, and brag about their children. All the mothers probably wear pink sweaters with their initials on them, made especially for oversized knockers. There was one lady, Donna, who kept calling to invite me to the parties. I always told her I was awfully busy in the home. I didn't want to talk to anyone. I felt happy in my own family. Ruby and I took Justy on trips to the grocery store, to the town lanes, to the police station. We showed the officer our baby, and we couldn't help saying with our whole selves, "Look at what we made. We finally came to some good, don't you see?" And when we bought a few groceries, I always liked exactly the things Ruby liked, no matter what. Ruby paid because he was the man of the family. When we came home, we danced around with the exercise shows on TV. And if we had it up so loud Justy cried, Ruby took him in his arms and danced with him around the circle of the house. In the evenings, after May got back, we were ready for a break. Justy always got cranky around 5. May cradled him and crooned. She had to tell him about her day in a high, squeaky voice while he stared at her and rolled his tongue around. He looked hard at her face, as if he was saying, "I know you're not my parents. I know that much. You look so strange." And Ruby and I sometimes said, if we could get a word in edgewise, "Hey, Ma, you want to watch Justy for a minute so we can feed the chickens?" She always said, "Sure I will. You run along." Here was something she could really be a star at, being an old grandma. It isn't as hard as being a mother, because you don't have to be responsible. You simply watch someone else doing most of the work, and you give them suggestions. Tell them what they're doing wrong. May was sure Justy smiled at her first, but she didn't know what she was talking about. I know for a fact that he grinned at me about a month before he even gave May the time of day. So we went out into the winter evenings and collected eggs, and if time allowed, we walked in the woods, all the while thinking about our Justin. We held hands, Ruby smoked a joint, and we told each other our thoughts, mainly what we wanted our son to be like when he got older. Ruby said with them hunky shoulders, he'd make a sensational quarterback. I said maybe Ruby could teach Justy to build houses, do work with his hands. Justy has long tapered fingers like candlesticks, the shape of May's before hers got twisted. They look like hands that could build sculptures or bridges. It burned me up that Ruby stopped making birdhouses. He stopped in his tracks when I mentioned the woodwork. It was still a sore spot with him. The way, all those months,